I'm going to be passionately serious in a few minutes, but right now I can't resist sharing a kind of odd little story with you. About 4 weeks ago, my preaching son in Oklahoma City called and asked if I would fill in for him last Sunday while he went out to Colorado to close a cabin, and I jokingly said, "I'll do that when the time comes, if between now and then you will get one of your rabid OU fans in the congregation to find a couple of tickets to any OU game. I don't care what it is, Baylor, Texas Tech, Oklahoma State, whatever." He calls me back and says, "Well, Dad, I have two tickets for you on the 50-yard line for the OU-Nebraska game." I'm creating envy, which is a sin. But you haven't heard the most interesting part of it. He emailed me last night and said, "You better be grateful to me forever, because I just saw on the internet that eBay is pricing those tickets, scalping prices, at $1,300 each. $2,600, it probably will hit $3,000 by Saturday. I have an ethical dilemma." If I had bought those tickets, if they had not been the sacrifice of a wonderful woman, I would have sold them and invited you all to the biggest party. So that's where I'll be next Saturday. And on the way back home, although it's quite a sacrifice for Billy, we're going to go over to Tulsa and worship with a cousin of mine in one of the fundamentalist churches in which I grew up. I thought I needed to remember what it was like. Switch to serious. It happened again 3 weeks ago at an outdoor wedding, 10,000 feet high on a mountain in Colorado, when one of the guests saw me fiddling with a battery-powered mic, there being no electricity as far as the eye could see. She came up and said, "Are you the, what do I call you?" We had such a mix of religions up there that day that I could almost see her brain clicking through the possibilities. Rabbi, father, reverend, pastor. Before she gave up on titles and simply picked a descriptive term she thought might be safe. "Are you the minister?" And when I confessed, she asks for some information. I gave it, and she melted back into a brave crowd of people who had almost destroyed their four-wheel drive trucks on a 45-minute scramble up a rocky trail to witness a marriage. Her brief struggle with titles was a minor moment in an afternoon of marvelous moments, and I quickly forgot about it until it came to mind again on the drive back to Wichita. I remembered that in July and August, I had delivered three sermons from this pulpit on how some of our traditional religious vocabulary can be misleading. The original meaning of the word saint, for example, and the word church, and what the real temple is in which God dwells. And I realized that there was one more left to complete that series. It has to do with the descriptive term the woman at the wedding finally settled on. Still another word we now use quite differently from the way the early church used it. The distinction we now make between clergy and laity The way we use the word minister to refer to one special class was unknown among the earliest Christian churches. When Paul speaks of becoming a minister of the gospel, the Greek word he uses, diakonos, means simply servant, and the word is still non-technical, just a descriptive term, not yet an official title. An early church did not have a single person who bore the title of the minister. All the members were ministers or servants. Timothy was a minister who preached. A woman named Nympha was a minister when she opened her home as a meeting place. I squirmed one day when I heard a seminary president tell a group of graduating preachers that they were, quote, a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation. He was quoting from a New Testament epistle, but the words had been actually written to people like all of you, not to a select few who had chosen to preach. Everywhere in the New Testament, the idea is the same. The church is not an organization served by one or two ministers, capital M, but a collection of ministers, that is, believers who serve. Because we don't know this, or perhaps because we so easily forget it, we often talk about what we call a lay ministry, a word which is used to describe a non-ordained, non-seminary trained preacher. But there is no ministry other than lay ministry, because the word laity comes from Laos, meaning the people. And those like Gary and me who preach are of the people and not separate from them. It's true that given a very different tradition and theology, a Roman Catholic priest can properly talk about a lay person. We probably shouldn't if we remember how the church was meant to function at first. Newspapers often write about a ministerial shortage. The early church could not have imagined such a problem because every member of the church was a minister. I read only recently about a church that is currently without a minister. In terms of early Christian usage, that would be like saying a congregation without a member. I understand, of course, that words come to have different connotations as people use them over long periods of time, and that only a terribly naive person would suppose it possible to turn back the clock. But I do think it can be useful to revisit a time in Christian history before professionalism changed the face of the church. I know a Methodist minister who identifies the congregation in his bulletin's responsive readings as, quote, all the ministers of this church, and then identifies himself as the pulpit minister. In other words, one of the many, the one called to serve with his mouth. He has the right idea, although his crusade is, I'm afraid, about as quixotic as this sermon, and not likely to change Christian vocabulary or practice. He does, however, have support from some of his peers, and I feel a little more comfortable this morning to know that I'm not alone in my sense of how rhetoric can affect reality. There isn't time to read supporting statements from J.B. Phillips, John Stott, Michael Green, the late C.S. Lewis, and many others who have known the scriptures so well. But here is a short summary of their views from an Anglican church official who spoke these words to a congregation in Coventry, England. Listen carefully. All orders are holy. Plumbers are as much in holy orders as the clergy, serving God and their fellows. Electricians, park keepers, doctors, and typists are all working as much with the things of God as the priest with the sacrament. I love hearing that confession made, and I wish I could hear it made more often. That man is not one of our church, but he speaks a classic congregational idea. And another Anglican in the country where Congregationalism was born writes a stinging paragraph of support in the London Church Times. Here is Bishop Stephen Bain. Bishop Bain. There is, he says, nobody stuffier than a parson who is acutely conscious of the privileges of his order, of his monopoly of theological learning, liturgical authority, general sanctity, and so on. The worst of it is that the laity so often believe in all this nonsense and put the sacred ministry on a pedestal until they feel that the only way a person can serve God is by being ordained. Well, I think Bishop Bain was probably not quite ready to give up his title, but he came close to saying that all believers have equal access to God, that his prayers have no more clout than yours. But that is not a popular idea. One of the small token gestures I used to make from time to time toward implementing the idea of the priesthood of all believers, the ministry of all the saints, was a request to board presidents and the church moderator and the program directors for Cook's Night Out and other special functions that they not invariably call on me to open meetings with a prayer, but invite other ministers around the room to address God. They humored me at times, bless them for their tolerance and goodwill, and the result has been some prayers of simple eloquence by male and female servants of God, diakonoi, ministers, whose sincerity and devotion blessed us that day. But someone always worries that perhaps the preaching minister will feel slighted if we do not make him or her the professional prayer maker. And so again and again we fall back on the convention of turning automatically to that person. I shall wish it were not so as long as I live, because it deprives the other member ministers present of a chance to shape their heart's desire in words, and by doing so, to grow in spiritual leadership. I heard a young man speak the other day of his plans to, quote, enter the ministry. He is a teacher. And I wanted to say, you are already in the ministry. But I try to save remarks like that for Sunday mornings, when there's a chance I may be understood and forgiven for peculiar idealism. I believe absolutely that it takes far more of the patience and wisdom and love of Christ to teach middle school students than to hire out to an upper middle class or even upper class church in the suburbs, or to dash off to Switzerland, as one of my friends did years ago, as a missionary. It's much harder, in my view, to be a Christian minister of medicine or politics, oh yes, or the environment than it is to deliver sermons in a church where most people in the audience already share your views and love you and want you to succeed. And to pick one more kind of ministry, think what a marvelous opportunity the Christian nurse has to serve her faith. She can say to patients when she tucks them in at night, God bless you and give you a good night's sleep, and I shall remember you in my prayers. And it can be extraordinarily comforting simply because she is not a religious professional, and such mercies are unexpected. Years ago, when I was recovering from surgery, it was fine to have the chaplain fulfill the obligations of his profession and stop by to say hello. But I'll tell you what was really impressive and unforgettable. That was when Dr. John Kaiser, who had not been my surgeon, took time from his own very busy schedule to go buy a book he thought I would like and to bring it to my hospital room. I was formally ordained. He wasn't. But in that moment, he was as truly a minister of the gospel as the most eloquent preacher you have ever heard in your life. I have to believe Jesus was thinking in this vein when, in the middle of a scorching sermon, he said of the professional clergy of his time, they love to be greeted with respect in public places and to have people call them rabbi. That was a coveted title among his own people. But here is the radical young reformer warning his little band how religious titles can make an artificial distinction about our importance in God's sight. Don't let people call you rabbi, or you may forget that there is only one, he said. In religion, don't call any man on earth your father, because only God deserves that title. Question: would he now mention some of those other titles that have become current and that that woman at the mountain wedding ran through while trying to figure out what to call me? I rather think he would. When my daughter was a student at KU, she used to join 1,000 other students on Sunday mornings to hear the Reverend Ron Sunby preach in his Methodist church. On those rare occasions when we could be in Lawrence on a Sunday, Billy and I would go with her. He said one day that he often felt his title cut him off from real life. Once people find out you're a reverend, he said, they begin acting differently. They think they have to discuss religion or ask for a prayer or be very nicey nice or, and this is more common, get away from you as soon as possible. He said, I shall never forget a call I made when I was at my church in Topeka. I went to see a family about joining the church. The man apparently was expecting someone else and had forgotten all about our appointment. After I rang the doorbell, he came to the door with a beer can, which he shoved in my face as he shouted, hi. When I said, hi, I'm Reverend Sunby, he shouted, oh my God, and leaped back into the house. It was a full 5 minutes before he could bring himself to let me in. This extraordinarily capable Methodist minister said he would like to live for a while without a title that, even when it is spoken with deference or affection, can have an alienating effect on some of the people one would like to know. I can sympathize with that. There is a clerk at Home Depot, better known as Home Depot, who knows that I preach and who intends to compliment me when I show up in a line by shouting, "Good morning, Reverend." He only means to be friendly and make me happy. But I can feel a physical spasm hit the hardworking customers with whom I've been talking while we waited in line. They stiffen slightly and get a little more cautious in their speech, not quite sure how to relate to someone who has just been revealed as a professional holy man. In the perceptive words of Ralph Waldo Emerson, my title, my calling, had had the unfortunate effect of disfranchising me from the real lives of ordinary people. As a wise old preacher told me once, long ago, it's one of the hazards of the profession. Now, you will misunderstand what I've been saying completely if you think my words are meant to diminish the importance of sincere and well-informed men and women who minister from a pulpit, whose ministry takes that form. I love what I do. I love the reading and the challenge of trying to shape a message that might be useful to you. I like the feel of interaction with an audience, the psychology of our special kind of relationship. What I do here, I like to tell myself, has some value, but I cannot treat a heart patient or write a legal brief or use an electron scanning microscope. And when members of this church do those things in service to others, they too are full-fledged Christian ministers. I am only one among many, and it is my deepest conviction that we fulfill the dream of Christ when on each Sunday morning what we have in this church is a gathering of ministers. Anyone who stands in a pulpit should remember often the declaration of Jesus that it is not those who say his name over and over in public places who are the truest of ministers, but those who actually do in the mundane daily business of life the will of God. St. Francis knew how the best sermons are preached, how deeds are more dependable than talk. He said something like this once: you should preach the gospel at all times. Sometimes you may even use words.